Welcome to a podcast of a sermon delivered at the Unitarian Society of Ridgewood in New Jersey. Our congregation is a place where you will find inspiration in the richness of diverse beliefs and the power of community. Detailed information about the Unitarian Society of Ridgewood is available on our website, uuridgewood.org.
Today is the fourth Sunday in January, the Sunday that typically falls closest to the anniversary of the United States Supreme Court decision in Roe v. Wade, issued on January 22, 1973. Now, last year I had planned to speak on the fourth Sunday of January on the topic of the right to an abortion. However, there was very heavy snow. And for the fourth time in 40 years of ministry, a service was canceled for snow. This year, the fourth Sunday in January, is today and the actual anniversary of Roe v. Wade, the 44th anniversary, which declared, based on a constitutional right to privacy, that a woman had the right to choose to have an abortion, although the states would have an interest in regulating abortion in the third trimester. I remember the time before Roe v. Wade. Not just access to abortion, but access to birth control was limited. In Massachusetts, where I lived, in 1969, 70, 71, abortion was illegal. The clergy consultation service, which began in New York but reached out and developed in other cities, helped women with unwanted pregnancies arrange for safe and legal abortions in states where those existed. When my girlfriend became pregnant, we traveled to New York City for an abortion. The decision in Roe v. Wade, which came a few years later, was an occasion of celebration. The writer Cather Paulet is a staunch advocate for every woman's right to choose to have an abortion. And in her book, Pro: Reclaiming Abortion Rights, she describes how throughout history and culture, women have been able to terminate pregnancies. That ability was part of women's knowledge, women's wisdom. And then she recounts a history of how abortion came to be banned in various places, leading up to today's culture wars in response to the knocking down of those bans. In fact, in today's culture wars, abortion is one of the few areas where the forces of social conservatism have not yet admitted that they've lost. In many others, they have. Her answer to demands that pro-choice advocates compromise with those who oppose abortion is that Roe v. Wade itself is a compromise. The decision acknowledged that the states have an interest in regulating abortion. For Paulet, this is a major and unjust compromise. However, my focus this morning is not going to be so much on a woman's right to have an abortion, which, for the record, I support without reservation. I will note, however, that I also support the right of a woman to decide that she morally cannot, as an individual, have an abortion. The point of choice is that there is choice. The choices of both women deserve our respect. That's what pro-choice means. The right to have an abortion is also the right to not have an abortion. But today, I want to speak more broadly about choice and choices. We do live in a world with a lot of choice, but our choices are not unlimited. But we do have significant choices, especially those of us who live in the world's wealthiest nation, in a relatively privileged part of the social structure of that nation. However, not all individuals have the same range of choices wherever they live in the social distribution. Some individual lives are more constrained by circumstances than are others. The distribution of innate talents is still a mystery to me. I don't know why some people have a talent for this and not for that. Why my brother is an outstanding musician, and I struggle with every bit of musical learning I've ever had. Some individuals' choices are limited by disability. Good or bad choices by parents limit or open up opportunities for their children. Personally, I have some talents and some areas of significant lack of talent. What I do have is a choice as to what I do with this reality. As an individual, some of what I receive from my parents and my extended family has given me strength and resources for my life, and some of what they gave me has hindered me. Opportunity is good in the first, psychotherapy in the second. My parents made some good choices and they made some bad choices. I have choices as to what to do with these circumstances, which are all conditions of my life. I try to make the best choices I can, but I'll bet I'm not the only parent in this room who said with chagrin, "I didn't want to do that. That's what my father or mother did, and I didn't like it." Structures of oppression constrain the choices of whole categories of individuals. Sexism is such a structure. Homophobia is such a structure. Racism is such a structure. Barriers to economic mobility constitute such a structure. Barriers such as unequal provision for education in different communities. There are many. Now, to hear some people speak today, you'd think that whiteness has become a barrier to choice. Now, whiteness takes its toll on white people, to be sure. Tandeika wrote a book on learning to be white, which talked in part about how white males in particular are damaged by the roles that a patriarchal, heterosexist white society demands of them. But whiteness brings a lot of privilege with it, and even the toll it does take on us is of a different nature and a lesser order than being part of a whole category of people subject to discrimination and disenfranchisement. Now, the rainbow flag and the Black Lives Matter banner on the front of this building are recognitions of the limitations imposed on whole categories of people by structures of oppression. So at any moment in time, each one of us has choices. Some choices are minor. Frosted flakes or shredded wheat. Raisin granola or maple nut granola. Some are more serious, such as the young woman who gets pregnant and does not want to be pregnant. And for one such woman, the choice may be obvious. For another, it may be difficult to make. Maybe you get two job offers, both in your field, and each job offer having some real pluses. But there are differences. One has a higher compensation package, but requires a lot of travel that will keep you away from home and family. The other is close to home, but even allowing for the savings that brings you in monetary terms, the compensation is lower and it may not be quite as much as you need. A tough choice. Each one of us faces major choices. Sometimes perhaps the choice is only among several bad options. and just make the best of a bad situation. Sometimes it is from many good options, and sometimes so many options it's hard to make a choice. Cheerios, whole grain Cheerios, frosted flakes, wheat bread. No. There are more important things too. Like when one of your kids gets admitted to 7 colleges and they're all good. Sometimes we approach a choice with dismay because there seem to be no real good options. Sometimes with fear and foreboding because the wrong choice can make things only worse. And other times with joy and hopefulness. And besides these personal choices, there are the choices we make about the world we live in and how we respond to it. Many of you here this morning were dismayed by the results of the presidential election. And I know this because some of you told me you were unhappy about the inauguration and what the new administration might bring. You had to find a way to choose how to respond. There was a whole lot of talk about moving to Canada after the election. Some people my age did that in the face of the draft 40 and 50 years ago. Some of you were tempted to withdraw in despair. Some no doubt drifted into depression. In fact, I know, maybe not in this room, but some other people I've talked to, there were real bouts of depression. Or you could choose to take some sort of action. Well, yesterday, some 2.5 million people at least around the world got into the streets to make the choice for action. 2.5 million. At least. And as for this Sunday, I had to make a choice. Was I going to rage about the inauguration? I'll tell you what I did. I didn't watch it. He wasn't going to get my TV ratings. Was I going to focus on the Roe v. Wade anniversary and the right to choose? Well, I've said something about that. Was I going to make people feel worse about the world? It would be easy to do. Or was I going to offer you some hope? I decided to choose hope. As I've said before, I want to say again, hope is not blind optimism. Hope is the sense that you can make meaning out of whatever's happening and maybe make a difference because you're engaged in it. You have hope not because it's easy, but because it's a challenge. Now, we Unitarian Universalists do not place our hope in divine intervention in response to our prayers. Even Unitarian Universalists will repeat that great saying about prayer. Prayer doesn't change God. Prayer changes people, and people change the world. Now, some of you will recall I spoke on December 11th on the heresy of hope. That is the choice to have hope. So I decided today I would continue in that vein. Now, there is some truth in Theodore Parker's declaration that although he could see little of the moral arc of the universe, what he could see bent towards justice. And that this came not from Scripture, but from history. That was quoted Monday at the Interfaith Martin Luther King service here in Ridgewood. And our speaker, Imam Zakir of Berkeley, did not credit it to Martin Luther King Jr. He credited it to a 19th century theologian, but not by name. But he also said what I would say. It bends towards justice because we bend it. Well, the support comes not from Scripture, but from history. So how about a little history? Some of you may know the name Stephen Prothero. He's a professor of religion at Boston University and a well-known commentator and author. His best-known book is one about religious literacy that came out maybe a dozen years ago. He also blogs for, I think it's CNN, but I'm not sure, on culture and religion. And his most recent book studies the culture wars that he says have been a fixture of culture in the United States since the birth of the Republic. The book is titled, Why Liberals Win the Culture Wars Even When They Lose Elections. And in it, he explains what a culture war is, how it begins, and how it proceeds. First, we toss this word culture war around. People have been talking about culture wars for the last few decades. Here's a good, precise description, and I quote here. First, they are public disputes recorded in such sources as presidential speeches, the congressional record, and popular books, magazines, and newspapers. Second, they extend beyond economic questions of taxing and spending to moral, religious, and cultural concerns, which are typically less amenable to negotiations and compromise. Third, they give rise to normative questions about the meaning of America and who is not a true American. Fourth, they are heated, fueled by the rhetoric of war and driven by the conviction that one's enemies are also the enemies of the nation. I think that's a pretty good definition of what we mean by culture wars. Now, culture is constantly changing, and culture wars arise when there a significant group of people are disturbed by the changes. He describes culture wars as being between cultural conservatives and cultural liberals. And cultural conservative is not the same thing as political conservative, and cultural liberal is not the same thing as political liberal. There may be connections, but they're not identical. Cultural conservatism, he writes, is characterized by an anxiety over beloved forms of life that are passing away, a commitment to restore what has been lost, and an effort to exclude from full cultural citizenship those who are responsible for that loss. End of quote. Cultural liberalism, on the other hand, is, quote, characterized by an eagerness to embrace new forms of culture, a belief in progress, and a determination to include more and more groups in the public life of the nation. End of quote. Now, I'm willing to bet that most of us would fit in the category of cultural liberals, but we might not fit there on every change and every time. I mean, there are certainly things that have declined since I was young that I'm not happy about, like just plain basic manners. That was the downside of letting it all hang out 40 and 50 years ago. Well, the terms cultural conservative and cultural liberal are not identical to political conservative and political liberal. And in his book, he describes five episodes from United States history, which he does not claim are all the culture wars that ever happened, but five episodes. And here he traces and shows that it's not the liberals who start the culture wars. Is the cultural conservatives who launch culture wars as the society has already changed around them, and they fear the changes. He starts with the early republic. The dispute between those who opposed established religions, tax-supported churches, and those who would build a wall of separation, or those who would support them. Epitomized by Thomas Jefferson for the Wall of Separation, and John Adams, also Unitarian, for the support of the tax-supported Standing Order of New England. And it was also about where did the responsibility for moral education lie and moral reinforcement? For the Jeffersonians, it was with the state. For the Adams and his sort, it was with the churches. In the 1830s, the anti-Catholicism that flared into violence and riots, as Protestants of largely British background felt threatened by the growing population of Catholics who were mostly from Ireland at that point. In the 1840s and 50s, you had the efforts to suppress Mormonism, which was seen as subversive of Protestant culture and values. In the 1920s, Prohibition, which was not entirely about the production of alcohol. There had long been a temperance movement in this country, and it had never gotten very far, and it had focused on drinking by immigrants and working class people. And that's what Prohibition was about. The rich folk would get their gin and their bourbon, but those dirty immigrants had to be kept out of the taverns and from drinking on the streets. And in the 1990s, the contemporary culture wars, which had to do with such things as recreational drugs, religious pluralism, sex outside of marriage, and abortion, among other things. Now, religious pluralism was always an element in the others, as you think of it. Established church, non-established free churches. Protestant dominance, welcoming of Catholics. Suppression of Mormons or engagement of a new and different religion into the society. Who would be able to drink or not drink? Many of those who were seen as dirty immigrants also happened to be Catholic. And religious pluralism, you know, what were the culture wars about if not also the influx of Eastern religions and new religions into American society in the 60s and 70s. And most recently, the culture wars, the contemporary ones, the remaining issue of the original version of that is that of abortion. Because basically, the cultural conservatives have, for the most part, given up on religious uniformity, on recreational drug use. They know they lost the battle on same-sex marriage and other gay rights. And now they've added anti-Muslim, which wasn't there 30 years ago when the current culture war started, which looks an awful lot like the earlier anti-Catholicism. Well, in several of these episodes, Prothero tells us, electoral majorities from more than one party supported the culturally conservative position. It did not align with the usual political alignments. But eventually, the cultural conservatives lost out because the whole culture was shifting, even as they were trying to hold it back. Ultimately, the Jeffersonians prevailed in the separation of church and state and cultural acceptance of religious pluralism. Catholics were accepted as Americans by the time of the Civil War, although, as I said, one impetus of Prohibition was the last gasp of anti-Catholicism, as embodied in prejudice against immigrants, this time from Southern Europe. Mormon leaders wanted to be part of the United States and eventually compromised on the issue of plural marriage in order to become part of the United States, having settled in the territory of Utah, but otherwise kept their distinctive practices and beliefs, which are very different from most of Protestantism, but are now fully accepted as Americans. This is what he means by the liberals ultimately always win. The contemporary cultural wars keep shifting, but for one example, we now have same-sex marriage. For another, religious pluralism is widely accepted even by many conservative Christians. Not all, but many. Sexual mores have shifted so publicly since the 1960s that anti-abortionism, anti-Muslim prejudice may be the last battle lines of the contemporary culture wars. Sexual mores have shifted so much that I just read an essay by a professor at Rutgers University about sexual ethics as a single black woman who is a born-again Christian. Fascinating essay. It's in the Crunk Feminist collection, just published. With each of these episodes in history, American society became more open, more religiously and culturally pluralistic, more respectful of individual rights, and therefore more amenable to individual choices. Now, it is still not fully all these things, either literally or culturally, but legally or culturally, but each of these episodes brought more openness. The two major battles still in progress are serious. There may be, as there were in earlier episodes, losses and steps backward, as well as steps forward in the culture wars. The so-called religious right, which was one force of cultural conservatives in our time, has surrendered on most of the rest of the issues as norms for the whole society. And I'll just add that religious conservatives are entitled to conservative mores within their faith communities, but they can't impose them on others. So all this is not to say that there are not real threats in the present situation. There are. It is to say that the arc of United States history has been towards more openness, greater pluralism, and enlarged freedom, even as there have been attacks along the way. And while Americans continue to have complex and conflicting opinions about abortion, there is not among the people as a whole, liberal or conservative, a passionate desire to go back to the days before Roe v. Wade. The conservative culture warriors want to go there, but real life is more complicated than ideology. Only 20% of Americans, at most, support a total ban on abortion. It's not a trivial number, but it's clearly a minority. A higher percentage approve of a woman having complete freedom to choose, but not a strong majority. A clear majority, for sure, supports the right to choose, even if there are certain limitations and boundaries to it. So, but the culture warriors will not get the message very anytime soon that they are on the losing side of history. Nor will they accept the legitimacy of Islam, which was first brought here on the slave ships in the 1600s, and has been practiced by free people in this country since at least the early 1800s. There were a few Muslim officers in the Union Army, as well as recruits. And it has been a significant religious presence in more urban parts of this country for at least a century. No, the cultural conservatives are afraid of the loss of a way of life and a culture that was well on its way out 40 years ago, as are the white males who seem to think that they are victims of oppression now, but are really just losing privileges we never deserve to have. By and large, the cultural liberals have won most of the battles. Cultural liberals may even hold cultural conservative positions on some issues, and as I said, I do have a few myself. But here's a wonderful example of what this is today. Former Vice President Joseph Biden is an example of a cultural liberal who holds some strong culturally conservative mores. He explicitly accepts Roman Catholic teachings about conception and the beginning of life. He has said that over and over again, but he refuses to impose his beliefs on others. And he has become, over the years, more and more consistently liberal on this point. 10 years ago, he only had a 30% rating from NARAL, Pro-Choice America. This past year, it was 100%. Although there are many vocal opponents of abortion, it seems to me that at least a majority, exactly how large a majority is not clear, is content to leave the choice to have or not have an abortion to the pregnant woman. And this is true of many individuals whose own moral compass would never allow them themselves to make that choice. I know from my pastoral experience women who are committed to the right to choose to have an abortion, but who would not themselves have one. I know such women. I know several UU women who, after having several children, having a birth control failure resulting in unplanned pregnancy and quite readily accessible to abortion services, decided to carry the baby to term. Others have chosen to have an abortion under those circumstances. The point is that people have the right to make the choice freely, as they do so in so many other areas of their lives. Yesterday, the cultural liberals were out in force in Washington, New York, and in 600 other places around the world. Certainly in much greater numbers than we've seen the cultural conservatives out anywhere lately. So perhaps this is the time, even when there is threat from the incoming administration and its supporters, when the future really opens up. Opens up because of the adversity that cultural liberals face and need to respond to. The numbers we saw in women's marches around the globe remind me of these words of the poet Nikki Giovanni. I would not reject my strength, though its source is not choice, but responsibility. The choice to join the women's march was not trivial. For many, it was easy, because it was clearly a choice for responsibility. Unitarian Universalism is a faith that promotes and thrives on freedom and openness. Not because anything goes, but because the truth is larger than any one of us can know. Because humanity is large and complicated and diverse. Because the moral arc of the universe bends towards justice when men and women together choose to bend it that way. In your individual life, and in your life as a citizen, may you live with the hope of making wise choices for the many presented to you and the confidence that you can carry them through. Amen.